Hello and welcome to the Doc Arena podcast in association with Film Ireland. My name is Ross Whittaker, and every fortnight or so, I talk to documentary filmmakers about their films, both in terms of the subjects they choose and the way in which they fund, craft and distribute their work. In this episode, it was fantastic to have the opportunity to talk to Oscar, BAFTA and Grammy winning director Kevin MacDonald, whose films include One Day in September, Touching the Void, Last King of Scotland, Whitney and Marley. The recording is taken from a masterclass at the Dublin International Film Festival, in which I spoke to him about his career to date, as well as his latest film, John Galliano, High and Low, which is now in cinemas.
Even though I've watched so many of your films over the years and been quite a big fan, really, I wasn't really aware of where you'd started, and that was a film about your own grandfather.
Yeah.
And when you learn that, it sort of, it makes a lot of sense, you know. Can you talk a little bit about that beginning?
Yeah, so
Had you wanted to be a documentary maker before that?
No, I hadn't wanted to be I hadn't thought of being a filmmaker at all. And I studied English literature at uni, and I thought, you know, I wanted to be a writer of some sort, but I thought journalist. But when I left university, it was kind of like 89, I went away for a year traveling, came back, and it was like big recession in London anyway, and couldn't get a job. I went to every newspaper trying to get a job, trying to get an internship, whatever, couldn't get, and then was doing odd jobs. But around that same time, my grandfather died, and my grandfather was a very well-known screenwriter, filmmaker, Emmerich Pressburger, who with Michael Powell made a lot of great classic British films in the 1940s and 50s. And he's now considered, those films are now considered to be kind of classics, but back in the 80s, 70s, 80s, they were completely forgotten, those films.
Okay.
And so he died living in a tiny cottage in the middle of nowhere in the Suffolk in England. And, you know, I think three people came to his funeral. And I thought, gosh, I should write a book about him before everyone who knew him dies, because his life story was incredible. He was born into a Jewish family in Hungary in 1902, made films in Germany and then in France, always ahead of the war, ended up in England. And I thought, it's a great story. So I was lucky enough to meet a publisher at a party I went to, who said, oh, yeah, well, I'll give you £1,000 to write a book about that. Sounds good. So I wrote that book. And then doing that book, I had to watch all his films and watch lots of films from, you know, from the 40s through to the present day, really, to research. And I kind of fell in love with film. And in order to finish the research in the book, I had to go to Eastern Europe. I didn't have any money to do that. But then somebody from Channel 4 in London said, oh, you know, if you make a documentary, we'll give you some money to go. So I ended up making the documentary, my first documentary about him. It's a terrible film, but that was the way I got to finish that book. And then that led me to think, oh, I'm now really interested in film, and maybe that's what I want to do. So I started making little short documentaries for fun, really, and then one of them got picked up by the BBC in Scotland, where I was living, and one thing led to another. I started making more and more, more and more. And then after I made Touching the Void, because that was actually I think the first British documentary that had been a commercial success. It made a lot of money everywhere in the world. And suddenly people were saying, oh, do you want to make a feature film? And I didn't really want to make a feature film, but I thought, this might be the only opportunity I get to do it. So I did it for that reason.
Wow, but I mean, going back to that first film, your grandfather is obviously a revered filmmaker, and I think there's a documentary out about him at the moment, or coming out very soon?
Well, funnily enough, I've just come back from Berlin, where they were showing a documentary about him and Michael Powell, made by Martin Scorsese, which is about as good as you can get, and it's all about, you know, how he's really the person who rediscovered them and brought them back into public awareness. And they're kind of his favorite filmmakers. So he does this documentary where it's very conventional. It's just him sitting in a big chair talking to the camera, but he does it with such passion. And he explains what's special about the films and the clips that he shows. And then he compares it to things in his own films. And so he says, oh, you know, this shot in this opera film that they did influence what I did in Taxi Driver, and this way, and he shows the clips and he explains why. So that it's really interesting,
And it's did you know your grandfather? Because I read that
I did a bit. Yeah, he died when I was 20 or 21, just as I was leaving university.
Okay, and you didn't. when you then started getting into filmmaking, do you think that connection gave you any kind of extra feeling of, you know, connection to this profession?
Well, Powell and Pressburg are famous for making films that are the opposite of documentary. So no, their films are like, you know, color and music and fantasy. And I've always been drawn to kind of reality for whatever reason and a more journalistic attitude to filmmaking. So not really. I think the only influence was that, first of all, I got interested in film by writing about his life, and also because I guess when you've had somebody in your family who's done whatever career it is, you think, oh, that's a fairly normal thing to do. You're not put off by the, you know, you're not intimidated by the idea, oh, I can't do that, I don't know how to do that. I felt like it was a perfectly normal thing for me to do. And actually, you know, I didn't have, people always think, you know, your grandfather's this famous filmmaker. Because he was so completely forgotten, it wasn't as though I could phone up, you know, Dickie Attenborough and say, Dickie, how about a job? It was, you know, it didn't mean I knew anybody.
Yeah, so you went on to make a few documentaries, as you say, and then One Day in September became your first feature-length film.
Yes.
Right? It's interesting. I would like to just read something out that you said about that film, if I have it here. It's probably on the back. Okay. In broad terms, we were trying to make a piece of entertainment. It's not an entertaining story. It's not a movie to which you'd take a date, but it's entertaining in the sense that we're trying to tell what is a fantastically interesting story in the strongest way possible to keep the audience gripped by it. And that was one of the main things we tried to do. We asked ourselves, what would happen if you took a really serious topic, did an investigation, and then reported it in a way that people usually associate with a fiction film, concentrating on narrative and tension? That was the basis of the project. I mean, it's for your first feature to have that strong a vision of what you wanted to do, what had kind of built up to that in terms of, this is the way I will make films?
Well, I started making documentaries, you know, for the BBC and Channel 4, and a bit fast began to feel like it's a bit, you know, they're all a bit the same. There's a formula. At that time, it was very much, you know, 50-minute films, and they had to do this, this, and this. I mean, there was a lot more work around in documentary than for television, but it was all, well, the kind of stuff that I was being offered to do was quite limited. And I'd written this book already about my grandfather, and I knew the publishers Faber and Faber, who had published that book. And I said, what about if I write a book about documentary, or, you know, with my friend Mark Cousins, who I'm sure you all know, I'm sure he comes to this festival a lot. And so Mark and I got to know each other at the Edinburgh Film Festival in the early 90s. And together we edited a book called The Faber Book of Documentary. And the real reason to do that was to educate myself in what are the possibilities of documentary film, what are the things you can do, what have been done in the history, you know, the 100-year history of cinema at that time with documentary. And so it was a kind of, it's a book that I still go to and leaf through when I'm looking for, when I'm taking on a new project, and I think, well, what idea could I steal from what somebody else did, you know, in the 1930s or something? And Life in a Day, which is the series of films I've made using clips from all around the world, all filmed on the same day, that was directly came from something that was in that book, a filmmaker called Humphrey Jennings, great British filmmaker, and some of the things that he had done. So doing that book had given me a sense of, oh, the possibility, there are big possibilities for documentaries, and people don't, in Britain at that time, people weren't really paying much attention to what those possibilities were. They were stuck in thinking, oh, I'm making a living making these TV documentaries. And so I got together with producer John Batsick, and we said, let's make a feature documentary that's a thriller, that works like a thriller. And the other inspiration for me actually was watching the Oliver Stone film, JFK, which is, you know, it's obviously conspiracy, Nazi kind of thing in its own way, but it uses a lot of real footage and real people and things, and mixes reality with fiction. In a way that I thought was really tremendously exciting and I hadn't seen before. And the first hour of that film still is an amazing piece of filmmaking and editing. So I thought that was my kind of filmmaking inspiration, that film. And I'd also been to see, you know, there was this, a couple of American films, documentaries had come out in cinemas in Britain in the mid-90s. There was Hoop Dreams, When We Were Kings, both sporting, one about basketball, one about boxing. And I remember going to see those in the cinema and how an audience was, the audience was held completely wrapped by them. And they responded in such an emotional way to them. And I thought, this is better than going to see a fiction film in the cinema. That document, it was like a revelation thing. Oh, documentaries can really work in the cinema. And that really excited me. So we found this subject, which was about the Munich Olympic Games massacre. And I had found a story about how some of the people, well, the family of the Israeli victims, you know, didn't believe the official version of the truth. And as it turned out, they were right not to, because we'd uncovered all of this stuff that happened. So that was the first feature documentary I did, and in
having that approach, I know it went on to win an Oscar, but how did people in the documentary community react to that approach? If it felt a little bit different?
I'd say the vast majority of people hated it because they felt that it was kind of exploitative, you know, manipulative more than exploitative. And insensitive in some way, to put sort of like, you know, thrills before other things. I think now when I look back on it, I agree with them probably. But, you know, youthful passion and wanting to do something different. And I think, so people outside of the kind of little documentary world really liked it, and it did very well. And it, I think, influenced a lot of filmmaking that happened after that, particularly on TV actually, where, you know, people started to make everything like it was a thriller. every non-fiction thing. So, and I think, you know, a lot of probably very bad influence it had on things.
But it's so common now for that to be the approach. If you watch One Day in September from this remove, you don't think anything of that.
Exactly. At the time, it was kind of that people were quite disapproving. People in the documentary world were quite disapproving of it, yeah. It got the most amazingly diverse reviews of any film. You know, it got 1 stars and 5 stars, and sort of like a lot of argument about it. And also, you know, as anyone who's ever worked on anything to do with, you know, Israel Palestine knows, you can't get it right. You're always going to stir up the resentment or passions of people on the other side of the debate who have a different viewpoint of it. And so that makes it very stressful. I mean, I think it was probably the response to that film was probably the most stressful experience I've ever had in my life, actually. And as a direct consequence of that, I got offered to make a film with Mick Jagger. And I was like so happy to do something frivolous. I thought, I want to go and just hang out with Mick Jagger and fly around in private jets. I thought, that's all I want to do now. Because I was a bit traumatized by the experience of making it. I remember waking up in the morning, I think the weekend of the film came out in cinemas in the UK, and the headline in The Guardian, you know, they had a color headline at the top and then the story, but the color headline, which was like what's going to be on the front of the part two, you know, of the paper, said, "Why this film should not have won an Oscar." Across the thing, and I was like, oh God, this is kind of like so stressful. Yeah.
But it did win an Oscar. And I mean, I'm kind of interested to know at that stage, how did that experience of it being so fated and winning that award affect your career? And you know, you had obviously, by the sounds of things, you and John Batzik had developed that project together. Does it suddenly change all that suddenly people are coming to you, Mick Jagger? And people?
Well, Mick Jagger came to me, yeah. And that was, it turned out to be, you know, not a great, it was a very tremendously fun experience, but of course I learned a big lesson, which is if you're working with a celebrity, make sure you've got final cut. And I didn't have final cut, so the film was taken away from me and re-edited, and it's not, the final film was not very interesting. But you've got to learn that lesson. But it was a fun and frivolous time, actually. And then, I didn't get offered lots of things.
Okay.
And it was only then I read this book, Touching the Void, and I was so loved that book and tried to figure out how would you make that as a documentary. You know, you couldn't really make it as a fiction film because it's all about what goes on inside people's heads, but it's not a documentary because it's happened in the past and there's no archive footage, so how do you do that? And that sort of technical challenge, that sort of conceptual challenge, that was what really, you know, drove me in making that film.
Will we watch the trailer for Touching the Void?
Go for
Why
it.
Why not? If we could see the trailer for Touching the Void.
We knew a number of expeditions had failed on it, so we knew it was hard. At some point, you're going to have to rely wholly on your partner.
I didn't really know what I was letting myself in for.
We just lost control.
I just felt it was best to get as far away as possible.
I was just convinced he was dead.
As soon as I saw it, I knew it had been cut. I thought, this is it. This is as far as this game goes.
Good trailer.
Good trailer. Stands up.
I haven't seen that trailer since the film came out, actually. It's really good. It made me want to see it.
So you've been criticised one day in September for making it too dramatic and using
yes.
fictional elements.
Yes.
But it obviously didn't stop you from doing this.
I think, that, interestingly, this film got treated more like a fiction film in a way, and it was distributed more like a fiction film. Large numbers of people went to see it, and that meant that actually it didn't even get nominated for the Oscars because they were all like, but it's not a documentary. So at that time it was, it kind of went too far. And I guess it was natural after doing that would do a full-on fiction film, which I then did. But ever since I've kind of alternated between both. I've done a lot of documentaries, and I've done a few handful of fiction films.
Were you into mountaineering and
no,
going places
not at
like
all.
This?
Not at all.
So how do you prepare then to do something like this?
It was physically really demanding, and I think it's one of those things where if you'd known how difficult it would be, you wouldn't have entered into it. And we went to the Andes, to where the incident happened. We went with the survivors, the two guys who were in the film, and a bunch of mountaineers, and we, spent a month there up in the mountains. Then we spent another month in the Alps filming the stuff in the crevasse and under the ice and everything. And it was, I got very fit for the first and only time in my life. And I think when you don't know anything, it's one of the things I like about documentary is, I've made a film about, which is showing here tonight, about a fashion designer, and I don't know anything about fashion, but it's a great joy to learn about a world that, that you only know, you've seen from the outside. It's intriguing, but to have the opportunity to spend a year immersing yourself in it, it's like an adult education program, isn't it?
Yeah.
And this was like adult education program in mountaineering and understand the psychology of mountaineers. And I love that aspect of immersing myself in a different world.
And how do you do that? Do you go and read everything you can about it? Do you
talk to people. I just talk to people. I developed this technique on this film, which I then use all my documentaries since then, which is that I try not to meet the people I'm going to film until I'm there with a camera. And I do a bit of research, but I don't necessarily do a lot of research because I want to be ignorant like the audience is in a way, and I want to find out on camera from them and have things explained to me. So I know that I've done a bit of reading or whatever, but I don't figure it all out in my head and things beforehand, so that when I'm talking to people or when I'm just there watching them with a camera, I'm sort of have a real curiosity about it. And that, because I think one of the things that I learned is that when you, If you know exactly what the film's going to be yourself going into it, it's going to be dead on the screen because, well, you're just sort of, you know, going through the motions of something. All good films, all good documentary films, I think, take on a life of their own, and you can't control them. And if you try and control them too much, you'll kill it. You have to be in that state of sort of ready for anything, and looking for the things that are just going to spontaneously happen and take the story off or take the character off in ways that you don't expect.
Are you concerned at all that you'll like completely miss something? You know, in you've done all your interviews and then you're sitting in the edit suite and the editor says, would you not have asked him this?
That's a familiar voice in my ear. That definitely does happen. Often I'll go back and interview people again, okay, and do little, like pickups and things, but it doesn't happen that often. There might be one or two things. And maybe there's usually other ways of getting that information across. I don't know. But I think I just think it's a delicate balance, especially if you're making something that is largely set in the past, you know. So in a weird way, it is sort of predetermined, and there's very little room there for life to seep in and to make something come alive. So there's an interesting instance in the John Galliano film that I've got playing here, which, you know, it's largely a past story. It's largely in retrospective. But the bit where the film really comes alive is where he's talking and he says something that I wasn't expecting, that he wasn't expecting, and which takes the story off in a totally different direction. And I'm not sure that would have happened if I'd been too prepared.
Yeah. No, I know. I've come across it recently where you see people where the script is written before the interview, and you just think, well,
I don't understand that. I mean, it's a very kind of Netflixy thing. They want to see everything written down, and they want to see, you know, conform to the structure and do. To me, that always feels like, what's the point in making the film? I might as well read the book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In this film, you're working with actors. And so on. Was that the first time you'd done that?
Yeah. So the two guys who played Simon and Joe, the two characters in Touching the Void, the two main characters, they were young actors. They hadn't done very much at all. I think they'd both done a little bit of climbing, but not much. And they went on a sort of climbing course before they did the film. And a lot of the real technical climbing at high altitude, which we filmed, was actually doubles. So it was other climbers pretending to be them. One of the great advantages of, you know, a climbing movie is that people are wearing hoods all the time, so you never it's snowing and they've got goggles on, so you don't recognize them, which is actually really good. And I still get people saying, oh my God, how did you get all that incredible footage from the incident that happened in the Andes? Why was there a film crew following them? Like, no, there wasn't a film crew following them.
Oh, wow. So how was that for you in terms of working with actors for the first time, and how has that evolved? Like, you've gone on to work with, I don't know, like so many great actors over the years in fictional films, from, you know, Jodie Foster, who's obviously on a lot of, you know, very present at the moment, to Russell Crowe, I mean, Oscar winners.
Yeah.
How's that process been from that point and developing that kind of side of your craft?
With the two young actors who were in this, I didn't feel any, you know, I was very happy just to sort of boss them around and tell them what to do. And they didn't have sort of dialogue, so much dialogue. And so they were much more just sort of puppets. So that sounds like an Australian friend of mine always calls the actors the meat puppets, which I just think is is like the worst thing you could ever say. But anyway, but in that film, I suppose I wasn't working with them as actors. And then when I did The Last King of Scotland, and I was working with very experienced actors, and a mixture of very experienced actors and local Ugandans who had, you know, not done very much or nothing at all, I did find it quite intimidating. And it took me a couple of films before I felt comfortable with actors, because what they do is so magical. And you get a good actor and they transform a couple of lines of dialogue that were sort of seemed like they were about nothing on the page, really, and suddenly it's like, oh my God, oh, I didn't even understand all those layers in that. And they can really bring things to life. And really save your bacon often as well, you know, when you're late and you don't have time to finish film a scene properly, often it's an actor who'll say, what about if I just stand over there by the door and lean in and say da 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 da, and you can do it all in a 1 hour and fantastic, and you go, wow, that's great. I mean, I had a great experience recently with Jodie Foster, who hadn't acted for a number of years, and I kind of had semi-retired, I think, and she really liked this project we were doing, The Mauritanian, and she got on board, and I was terrified, thinking, oh, she's a two-time Oscar winner, she's a director of some note herself, you know, this is going to be awful. But actually, she turned out to be, of all the actors pretty much I've ever worked with, the most responsive to direction, that you could say anything to her, and she would just go, yep, and she would do it, yep, and she would do it. Because I think maybe she'd also, because she'd been an actor. But also she said to me that she said right at the beginning, she said, you'll find me different than most actors. I don't have an actor's character. And I said, oh, and what does she mean by that? And she said, well, I was a child actor, and it wasn't my choice to become an actor. My mother wanted me to be an actor. And so I think she'd never had that kind of excessive kind of showing off or ego or whatever that drives actors often to begin with. She doesn't have that. She's a very level-headed, kind of straightforward person who happens to have this amazing, amazing, amazing talent.
So how's your approach to the actors evolved? And do you have different techniques that you've kind of come to use?
It depends who you're working with. Obviously, if you're working with non-professionals, then it's one thing, and it's often about just doing it many, many, many times. But you have to realize, you have to figure out, some actors are always going to be great on the first take, and maybe they're acting opposite someone who's great on take 11. And you've got to figure out how do I make that work, and you have to change the way you shoot it. So maybe you're thinking of doing it in a two shot, and you end up doing it, having to do it in singles, because you know that actor who's only good on take 11 is, you know, by the time they get to their good take, you know, the other actor is going to be tired and bored. So there's those sorts of things you have to consider. But I think more than anything else, the thing I learned right from the very beginning working with actors is that is to trust them and to not over-direct, not to try and get them to do exactly what I want, to actually allow them to be free to try different things out and to make mistakes. And I'll often encourage them, you know, to do a couple of takes like the script, and they say, well, you know, be freer with it, you know, improvise a little bit if you want, you know, how, you know, maybe this line here you could add in a couple of other things about what you feel or whatever. So encourage them to sort of go somewhere else with the script, and often that results in something quite interesting. Often you don't necessarily use the lines that have been added or thrown in, but it changes the performance in some way. And makes it more real. And I think that's why I've always got on with actors, is that I'm the kind of director who I want them to do something amazing, and I'm going to record it. I'm not the kind of person who's kind of, I've got this amazing shot, which is like this, and you have to take two steps to the left, and they have to walk into the light, and look up, get the light, and I'm not doing that. I mean, those are kind of like the Hitchcockian kind of directors, the people, David Fincher's, a bit of that, who are incredibly controlled, incredibly, you know, visually expressive. I think I'm more interested in, you know, I want to feel that you as an actor are doing something emotionally amazing and accessible, and that's going to help tell my story, and I'm going to just record you doing that.
I'm going to ask you a couple of questions about Last King of Scotland, so maybe we'll just stick the trailer up to remind people
okay. A
little bit of the film.
How many doctors are there here?
Well, there's me, and now there's you.
Good morning, Dr. Garrigan.
The President wants to see you.
You are British.
Well, I'm Scottish.
Scottish?
Why didn't you say so?
This is the sort of man a president needs around him.
You want me to be your physician?
What do you mean?
Is to have some fun.
You are very naughty.
Me?
Dr. Garrigan, it's 4 a.m.
They've taken my passport. Go home now.
You cannot.
Have you any idea what's going on in this country?
He's changed, hasn't he?
He has always been like this.
You do as I say or you don't get out.
You want me to kill him?
I'm surrounded by traitors! Like my own son, and you have grossly offended your father.
You know, when I watched this again the other night, and I was thinking about it, and I was thinking, could you not have chosen something easier for your first fiction film? I mean, shooting in Africa, presumably. Yeah. You know, you've got a host of British and American, amazing British and American actors doing Ugandan accents.
Yeah.
There's action, there's guns, you know, there's so much in it. I mean, it must have been, well, I suspect it must have been a huge challenge to go from docks into this.
Yeah, again, I was pretty ignorant. I'd never really even been on a film set, like a feature film set, when I started directing it. I mean, that was the way, I'd obviously done Touching the Void, and I'd never done a short or anything like that. I'd never done a drama before. And luckily I had a great DP, Anthony Dodd-Mantle, who taught me a lot, and a great crew. But we shot it in Uganda, which I think was the best decision, and tried to do it in places where Amina really lived, and in the parliament, and they were very helpful and amenable. And I think, it's a bit like Touch of the Void. If you'd known how difficult it would be, you probably would have thought twice about it. Nowadays, I'd be much more practical. I'd be like, oh, God, that sounds like a nightmare. How do you know? God, going to Uganda, doing this, doing that. But actually, at the time, that was all really what excited me. And I was lucky enough to have James McAvoy right at the beginning of his career, and he was also up for everything and anything. And I remember it was one day that we had to do all these driving shots with him in this old Mercedes driving around. And he'd been sort of flying around bends, and then he came up to me at the end of the day and he said, I've got to tell you something, Kevin. I don't actually have my driving license. And I was like, oh my God. You can imagine nowadays that would just be insurance hell, whatever. But we were in Uganda, we were already filming, you know, nobody knew. So we just carried on and finished all the stunt driving that he was doing without having his driving license.
So, and when I watched the film again as well, I felt like, you know, there's a feeling of like a little bit of documentary methodology in some of this, and you know, where you put the camera and so on, and sometimes having that sense of witnessing a scene that you kind of mentioned.
Yes.
Did you really want to? I was trying to think of the time, and I know like United 93 also came out that year. A couple of years earlier was Bloody Sunday. Paul Greengrass was using. Was that something that was in your mind, like what your style was going to be as a fictional filmmaker?
Yes, I guess so. I mean, I think those films, or certainly Bloody Sunday, was somewhat influential. But I think there were also films at that time like Fernando Meirelles' film, which I now forget the name of, set in the slums of Rio de Janeiro. Which I'm sure you've
City of God.
Yes, City of God. Which I think it was quite a lot of influence of that. The film that's influenced me the most throughout my fiction career probably is The Battle of Algiers, which is, you know, like the great realist action kind of film from the 60s about the freedom, the independence struggle in Algeria. And so that's the film I always go back and look at when I'm doing something that's got, even when I did The Mauritanian a couple of years ago, that's the film I go and look at to say, how did they do this? How did they handle the torture? How did they handle this? And it's an interesting combination of kind of verite-like aspects, but also more considered and formal kind of filmmaking. But I feel like, you know, as a filmmaker, I feel totally at home in the world of documentary. When I'm doing fiction, I feel like I'm still learning. And I think that's what I like about it, is that I feel like I can get better at it.
Are there things that you're taking from one to the other as you go along, and have there been throughout the years, or do you see them as two completely separate strands?
There's definitely things. I mean, this is a thing I always say, but it's also true, which is that when I'm doing a documentary, I'm sort of gathering all this random stuff, and you're trying to then, in the cutting room, shape it into being like a feature film, into a fiction film. You're trying to make a story that really works, have you know, thematic impact, emotional impact, but you're using all this raw actuality. Whereas when you're making a fiction film, it's the absolute opposite. You've got this dead script there, and you've got these actors who aren't the people that they should be, and you're trying to imbue it with a documentary reality and excitement and sense of life. And I think I recognize that when I'm on a fiction film set, the moments I get most excited are where unexpected things happen, and the scene sort of goes somewhere different, which I think means that I'm at heart a documentary maker. You know, I like to, on the fiction set, sometimes create a bit of chaos, create a bit of a few problems or upset the actor or something, so that you get something that's not just what you're expecting.
I'm going to ask a couple more questions, and then we're going to open up to the floor for about 10 or 15 minutes. So, first of all, let's just show the trailer for John Galliano, your current film, yeah. High and Low. So that's playing tonight in the festival.
It isn't often that you meet a great designer, but when you saw what John was doing, you realized that he was one of them.
John was the best of his generation.
A very strong statement to make.
All of a sudden, fashion was like rock and roll.
I still remember him teaching me how to walk. He said, put your hips forward and lean back.
I always saw this little kid in him, very natural, full of energy and passion.
We wanted to be part of that magic.
I would see a lot of designers under pressure.
The shows were bigger, the stars were bigger, the attention was more.
After every collection, he would sit there and drink.
He was a bad drunk, really wanted to get wasted.
He got banned for about 20 hotels.
He was in the lift at the Ritz with no clothes on, and he was growling, telling everyone he was a liar.
He started to say ugly things about people.
I just thought, boy, that guy's unhappy.
Disgraced fashion designer John Galliano's in court today facing charges of anti-Semitic behaviour.
He didn't apologise. You feel betrayed?
John Galliano is out of Christian Dior.
There are people here who are absolutely disgusted by him.
Can you tell me how you think you ended up in that place?
Yeah, I'm going to tell you everything.
Another good trailer. You obviously have a good trailer cutter traveling around.
Yes,
with you.
Yes, well, I have to. That's Mubi did that. Who are distributing the film? Who are pretty great, and they.
You know, you've done this film, Whitney Houston, Bob Marley, and in those two cases, it feels like there's a big family drama element with this film.
Yes.
It feels like there's a kind of moral inquiry into the subject, as well as being portraits. Is that how you find your way into these films? Like, what's the other story?
I think that's it. I mean, I think with this and with the Whitney Houston film I did, I guess they have a similar. The Bob Marley is just because I'm like a huge Bob Marley fan, and I got the opportunity to go and make a 2.5-hour long film about Bob Marley and be in Jamaica for a year, and who would say no to that? And it was, it felt like, he feels to me like he's pretty much the most important pop star that there ever was internationally, and nobody had made a really good documentary about him before, which tried to explain his influences and understand him in that way. So that was a slightly different thing. But the Whitney Houston film and this film, I guess, come from the same place, which is a kind of sort of moral inquiry in a way, trying to understand a character. Who is this person? How did they end up being as they are? And also you know, Galliano in particular, I guess he's like the character in The Mauritanian, the Guantanamo inmate, or Forrest Whitaker's character in Last King of Scotland, in that they're morally really ambiguous. And you, as an audience member, have to kind of do a bit of work. You have to make your own mind up about them. And there's a lot of debate that comes with that, and uncertainty. And again, for me, that's that sense of, I don't really know what I think about them going into it, and I'm trying to work it out. To me, that's what makes it an interesting experience for me as a filmmaker, trying to figure out, do I like this person? Do I think they're talented? Do I think they should be forgiven? Should, you know, all of those questions are, yeah, are that sort of moral inquiry, the mystery story, actually. I think it's a kind of psychological mystery story about how do you really know what's going on inside other people's heads.
And you'd learned, obviously, with Mick Jagger to make sure you had final cut, which helps yes, a lot, I'm sure, in those situations.
Exactly. I haven't fallen into that trap again.
Do we have any questions from the audience? If you'd put your hand up, this man at the back. There's a microphone coming over to you. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks a million. It's really awesome to just hear how honest you are about your process. It's actually very comforting to hear. I'm curious to know how your motivation for making film has changed throughout the course of your career. You spoke about, you know, being excited by Uganda and different prospects, and I'm just curious to know now where you're at in your career, what has changed in your motivation to make work?
Well, that's such an interesting question, isn't it? I mean, I realized with some discomfort the other day that it's been 30 years since I made my first documentary, so I guess that qualifies as a long career now. And I think when you start off and you're full of, you just want to find your place in the industry, you know, and be given opportunities by people and earn a living at it and that. And then I found myself, you know, being dissatisfied with that and wanting to be more artistically experimental and more daring and do, you know, try and break rules. And I think that then through your, what I think when I look back honestly over, you know, the last 20 years of my career, say, the reasons I do films vary massively. Sometimes it is just a job; it's money. It's like, I don't have anything to do. Here's an interesting idea. I'll do this to pay the bills in a way. Sometimes it's because it's something you really, really want to do, and you feel deeply passionate about it. And the weird thing I've noticed is that actually the films that are well received, it has nothing to do with what the reason I did them for. Sometimes the ones that you really feel are personal, actually nobody else gets. And that's sort of taught me a lesson in a way, because I think I used to feel kind of a bit ashamed about the ones that I was doing, not because I really personally was driven to make them. But actually now I think, well, that, you know, why not? Because maybe I'll find something in that thing that's really deeply personal. But I think also the industry has changed so much, hasn't it? Because the kinds of films that I was making and they were showing at the cinema and making a reasonable amount of money at the cinema, it's now very, very hard to get the money to make those. They don't make money at the cinema. You know, so you're making them for streamers or for broadcasters, and they've got much tighter expectations and try and have more involvement maybe than traditional film financiers would have. So a lot has changed, but I suppose actually the thing that in the end, that I, when I look back over those 30 years, the thing that I can see consistently that turns me on is the idea of trying to do something new and different with documentary form. You know, I've made some very conventional films, but I've also, you know, things that are sort of like, oh, I could do that. I could take this idea from that book I edited with Mark Cousins and go, wouldn't it be fun to try something like this that's really out there? And I really enjoy matching the subject to the form in that way.
Okay, do we have another question? Just here at the back.
Hi, Kevin. I just want to say that I've loved your talk so far, and I find it really inspiring, all your stories. And the question I have for you is, would you prefer fiction films or documentaries in terms of storytelling? And do you think it would be a good place to start in documentaries and then move into features, or start in features and then move into documentaries? as a career path.
That's interesting. I think that there are very few fiction filmmakers who then go on to make good documentaries. But there are lots of documentary makers who go on to make good fiction films. So I think that's a better way to go. But also I think it depends, you know, what you're... If you're really interested in people and real stories, then obviously documentary is the place for you, you know. I think most documentarians have a kind of bit of a journalistic spirit in them. They want to find out, they're curious, they're nosy. That's sort of a thing. So if you're like that, then documentary is the place to go.
Hey, Kevin, thanks a million for the talk so far. It's really informative, really inspiring. You mentioned something towards the end that I found really curious just about how you view your subject or the person that you're making the documentary about in terms of how your feeling towards them changes, whether you uncover something that you may morally disagree with yourself. Do you find that has an impact on the film itself, or do you think that do you have to sit back and be objective about everything that you're seeing?
Well, of course, there's no such thing as objectivity, really. I mean, you can try, as I did in the Galliano film, to sort of play both sides and to present both sides. But your feelings for the person definitely always come across, and I think always should come across, because that's your particular stamp, your particular viewpoint, which is what I think an audience are going to respond to. They don't want something that's just made by algorithm, I think. But I think a lot of the subjects that seem to interest me are people who are ambiguous, you know, and who do I like him? Don't I? Even the James McAvoy character in Last King of Scotland, you know, he's a not very likable person. He's a sort of narcissistic arsehole in a way, you know. And I think that the interest in doing that film came out of me. After I left college, I went traveling, went to East Africa, and the feeling you have of kind of white privilege doing that, even though it wasn't called white privilege in those days, but that was then when I read the book, The Last King of Scotland, and I thought, oh, that character, he feels like I did then, you know, the color of my skin is giving me this advantage in this world, and that's what he feels going to Uganda. He feels like, you know, oh, nothing bad's going to happen to me because, you know, I'm well connected and I'm white. And I think I think those kinds of connections that you find with your own experience and the things that bother you in your own experience in particular, which you feel a bit uncomfortable at, those are always the things that I find myself drawn to.
Okay, another question. This woman over here.
Hi. Hello? Yeah. I was just wondering, I'm coming to the film later tonight, and I was wondering if you had ever worried about cancel culture yourself as a documentary filmmaker or storyteller. And you briefly talked about the story that you worked on between Israel and Palestine and that kind of thing. Did it make you rethink the kind of difficult stories you might want to tell in the future, that it could blow up your life?
Well, I'm generally pretty foolhardy, to be honest, and usually when somebody says, ooh, I think that might be a bit controversial, I'm like, ooh, where do I sign? So that's just me, but I definitely felt, after I made the film, you know, about the Munich Olympic Games, one in September, and the sort of the shit that hit me from every direction of the film, it definitely put me off making anything else in Israel, I have to say. You need a particular... You need to be pretty thick-skinned, I think. That's probably the only subject that I've gone, you know what, actually, I don't want to go, I've done it, and I don't want to go there again. But anything, I mean, I've never felt I was in danger of being cancelled, but maybe I was. But with this film, I think it's been interesting because he's a cancelled person and I'm making a film about him, and some people have responded, without seeing the film, have responded in a way of kind of like, why are you rehabilitating an anti-Semite? And I, well, that's not that's not what the film's about. It's not about rehabilitating him. It's about inquiring about why would somebody say this, and is he an anti-Semite, and where would that anti-Semitism come from, and all these questions, which I think are legitimate to ask, and interest me anyway. As I've got Jewish heritage, as I was saying, through my mother, and I don't tend to worry about that, but maybe I should.
Okay. Do we have another question? You mentioned the book that you wrote.
Yes. When
you go back and revisit that, is there a documentary that you would love to do, or an experiment that you want to do that you haven't been able to do yet, or maybe can't get financed? Is there something, an itch there that you haven't scratched?
Yeah, I mean, there isn't a particular documentary I want to make now. But I would like to have the opportunity. I mean, it's harder and harder to get the money to do things that are a bit different. And if somebody said to me, here's £1 million to make any film, any documentary that you like, there's a lot of interesting things I would like to, I'd like to try and do with that. There isn't one thing that I
can. Or an approach, a different stylistic.
Yeah, you're putting me on the spot. I can't think of anything. I'm sure there is, but I can't think
fair
of
enough,
anything.
Fair enough. Any other questions? Yeah. This man here.
Were there any big projects that you're presented by Hollywood that you took a pass on that ended up being masterpieces directed by someone else, or any like a comic book movie or anything like that? Anything big?
No, I mean I in the brief time when people were offering me things, big Hollywood things, I don't get offered those things now. If I get offered anything in Hollywood now, it's things I definitely wouldn't want to do. But in the brief few years when I was sort of a hot property, there were a few things. I mean, the one that my children are always annoyed at me about is that I was offered to do the pilot of Game of Thrones. And I remember going to lunch with the writer and sort of vaguely patronizing him about, does anyone really want to see this fantasy stuff? I don't know. I mean, so that's why. Yeah, there's a few like that. But I think anybody who's been in that situation, you always turn down a few things. But you can only do the things that actually interest you. And as I say, sometimes the things that really interest you, you turn out actually don't interest anybody. And sometimes, people are on the same wavelength as you, and you can't tell. And I think actually the Stephen Frears, who's a bit of a mentor to me back when I was starting off, I remember him sort of saying to me, you don't know what's going to hit, you don't know what's going to miss, so you've just got to keep making films. That's the only thing you can do, just keep going forward, make another one, and not worry about the response, not worry about, learn from it as you can, but you can't sort of chart your own direction from the response of the audience in the end.
Okay, another question from anyone? This gentleman in the middle over here.
How you doing? Just sort of like a follow-on to what you said. You kind of spoke about there about, kind of turning down projects that might not have been your thing, but kind of the inverse of that. Do you have any like one that got away scenarios where like a project that you felt really passionate or strongly towards that just, either couldn't get funding or just couldn't get off the ground for any other reason?
Yeah, several things like that. And there's a film which I tried to do first, like a slightly warped spy film, I suppose you would say it was. I tried to do it 14 years ago, and nobody wanted to do it. And then I tried to do it last year with Paul Mescal, and we were very close to doing it, and then he pulled out to go and do bloody Gladiator 2. So that's the longest running thing I've had, or something I've really wanted to do, but it's sort of, I think it's fated never to happen, that particular film.
Just, last thing I'd like to ask you is about the Life in a Day.
Yeah.
You haven't mentioned that really. So
yeah.
It sounds like you actually developed that yourself, and you've kept going back to it. What is it about that really attracts you? It's just, if anyone doesn't know what I'm talking about, it's a project that takes footage that's filmed by people around the world on one particular day,
yeah,
and kind of makes it into one film of the world for that?
Because I think it's, we've done two which are global, and then there's been various in different individual countries. There was a Britain in a day, and there's an India in a day, and there's various other ones. But the ones that I actually directed were the two worldwide ones, one in 2010 and one in 2020, which was during the pandemic, of course. And they were inspired by this Humphrey Jennings thing, which is in the book I did with Mark Cousins. Humphrey Jennings was part of British filmmaker in the 40s, documentary maker. He was part of, in the 1930s, this thing called mass observation, which was this movement in the UK where it was kind of like a way of trying to understand what ordinary people really thought about the world, what they really thought about the conditions, political and otherwise, around them. And so they asked people questions, and they asked them to write a diary once every month on a Thursday, whatever. And they collated all of this material that came in for people into these books, which were kind of like, here's a snapshot of Britain at this moment. And I thought that was kind of fantastic. And I thought, with cameras, obviously you can do that with a camera, and you can get people to film their day or film a snapshot of their day. And then if you put it together, you can create just this sort of little flash of, this is humanity at this moment. And I think a lot of my films are quite kind of, you know, narratively based, you know, they're quite sort of thrillery or whatever. Whereas what I loved about this is the absolute opposite. There's not really any story. There's a kind of a musical kind of movement through it. You know, it's almost like a symphonic kind of movement. And they're the kind of films you either get and you like, and you sort of immerse yourself in the emotion of them and the music of them and take it on board and find them quite emotional, or you absolutely hate them. Some people absolutely hate them because there's no story, there's no political motivation. But to me, it felt like that. There's a poetry. The poetry of the everyday, the poetry of ordinary life, and I find them really moving, and I think they're kind of like a really original kind of film. You know, I don't think anyone has done that. They've talked to a film, trying to move documentary into a new direction that it hadn't been in before.
Okay, great. Well, I think that's all we have time for. Thanks everyone for your questions and for coming along today. So, thank you, Kevin McCall.
Yeah, thanks very much. Thank you.
Thanks again to Kevin for taking part in the interview, and thanks to Dublin International Film Festival and Volta Pictures for allowing us to share the recording with you. John Galliano High and Low is available to watch in selected cinemas from March 8th, which means it's in cinemas right now. Thanks to Stephen Galvin and Film Ireland for supporting the podcast, and to film composer Michael Fleming for kindly allowing me to steal his music. You can find more of it at michaelflemingmusic.com. You'll find me on social platforms as Ross Whittaker TV. And of course, thanks to you for listening.